KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Welcome to Native America Calling, I'm Sean Spruce. New federal laws help curb sales of important sacred and cultural items taken from tribes, but keeping on top of those takes vigilance by repatriation advocates. There's also ongoing education and enforcement work. We'll get an update from those working in the repatriation field on the eve of their biggest annual conference this week. We'll also get updates on notable repatriation fights, including a dispute related to a Florida construction site. That's coming up after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Yurok Tribe and the Paula Band of Mission Indians are hosting this year's Missing and Murdered Indigenous Peoples Summit. It will take place in Paula, California, Tuesday and Wednesday. This is the third year the summit will be held. The event brings together tribal leaders, advocates, lawmakers, and law enforcement to address MMIP in the state. Yurok Chairman Joseph James says the summit addresses the root causes of the MMIP crisis, which he says is an unfortunate issue that negatively impacts every Indigenous person in the state. This year's summit will feature a youth panel, cultural sharing, and testimony from families. Topics include sex trafficking, the implementation of a statewide missing Indigenous person alert, and culture as healing. According to the tribe, California has the fifth highest rate of MMIP cases in the U.S. The summit is intended to help identify actionable, tribally driven solutions to combat MMIP. The devastation from January's Los Angeles wildfires is a reminder that extreme wildfires burn year-round. The Washoe Tribe of Nevada and California is working to reintroduce intentional cultural fire meant to restore forest health and reduce explosive fires. The Mountain West News Bureau's Caleb Bradel has more.
It's a sun-splashed afternoon in a forest near South Lake Tahoe, where large fir and pine trees stretch into the clear blue sky. Here, there are dozens of tribal members eager to learn about cultural burning. But first, they have to learn how to control and put out fires. That's why a group is huddled around a heavy-duty water pump with two thick fire hoses connected to it. One is in a tub of water, size of an above-ground pool, and the other is unraveled a few dozen yards away. Jeremy Miles Placencia is with the U.S. Forest Service and leading the demonstration.
We have everything connected. We have our discharge hose. Now we can set up the fuel line.
And then he revs up the water pump. Water pushes through the extended hose like a snake coming to life. Now participants can practice spraying pressurized water as if they were putting out a fire. One person soaking up that knowledge is 30-year-old Kyle Tabor Cooper. He's a member of the Nooksack tribe in Washington State, but lives in northern Nevada and is engaged to a member of the Washoe tribe.
I've met a lot of people that have inspired me to like get into this training and just show me like a different kind of way, like with cultural, intentional fire.
Cultural fires are restorative, not destructive. They're typically done on a smaller scale to take care of traditional medicine plants or other cultural resources that rely on fire.
So, for example, the Washoe tribe, our first two burns were burning a willow patch.
That's Rihanna Jones, the director of the Washoe tribe's Environmental Protection Department.
Washoes are famous for their baskets, making beautiful baskets. So when you burn the willows, they grow back better, straighter, with less secondary nodes.
But the Washoe tribe wasn't allowed to burn for more than a century. That's because of longtime colonial federal policies that prioritize suppression or putting out fires as soon as they start. Jones says that has hurt tribes and the health of many forests.
Fire suppression is like Indigenous culture and Indigenous people suppression as well. You know, they were not interested in, I think, learning from Indigenous people.
But that has started to change over the last decade. Now, many federal fire officials say decades of keeping fire off the land caused a buildup of highly flammable dead trees and brush, turning many forests into a tinderbox. And rising temperatures and drier conditions are adding even more fuel. A 2021 study led by UCLA found that climate change has been the main driver of the increase of fire weather in the West.
Climate change has had a huge effect with respect to drought, increase of pests and pathogens, and then increase of wildfire. So we're having these catastrophic huge wildfires coming through that we can't keep up with.
I'm Caleb Radel.
This story was originally produced for the climate radio show, Our Living Lands. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
See Renewal's expertise in energy, housing, land use, fire protection, and more in multi-jurisdictional environments helps tribes leverage existing assets, grow capacity, and gain competitive advantage. See Renewal supports this show. SEERenewal.com.
Enbridge strives to be a good steward of the environment, a safe operator of essential energy infrastructure, and a good neighbor. More on Enbridge's Indigenous Reconciliation Action Plan at Enbridge.com. Enbridge proudly supports this program.
When you file online for your PFD, every Alaskan can support great causes like National Native News. Just select KNBA-FM Kawanak Broadcast Corporation. With your support, you can help us make a difference in our community.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. Repatriation advocates are marking policy and enforcement victories as they gather this week for their annual conference. They're also mapping opportunities and hurdles that the new presidential administration might pose in terms of federal compliance with the 35-year-old Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act. Advocates are assessing the Donald Trump administration's rollback of diversity, equity, and inclusion practices and sweeping federal layoffs and funding freezes. Today on our show, we'll talk with repatriation experts about how they intend to strengthen ongoing work to return important items accumulated by institutions and private collectors. We'll also talk with a Miccosukee tribal member, raising awareness about artifacts and other items accumulated by a Florida real estate company that is sidestepping tribal consultation. Join the show with your comments or questions by calling 1-800-996-2848. 1-800-996-2848. That'll connect you with our studio in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and we'll share your comments on the air. Joining us now from the Tunica-Biloxi Tribe of Louisiana in Marksville, Louisiana, is Shannon O'Loughlin. She is the Chief Executive and Attorney for the Association on American Indian Affairs. She's also a citizen of the Choctaw Nation of Oklahoma. Shannon, hello, and welcome back to Native America Calling.
Hey, Hallie Toe there, Sean. How are you?
I'm doing well, Hallie Toe. And we also want to note that the Association on American Indian Affairs is a financial sponsor for Native America Calling's parent company, Kawanak Broadcast Corporation. Joining us from San Francisco, California, we have Sam Cohn. He is an attorney and partner at the Denver-based law firm Kaplan Kirsch LLP. He is Absalaga, also known as the Crow Tribe of Montana. Sam, good morning, and welcome to Native America Calling.
Good morning, Sean. Thank you. Good to be here with you. Good morning, Shannon.
Good to have you both on the show. Also joining us from Marksville, Louisiana, is Kim Mettler. She is Next Generations Director at the Association on American Indian Affairs and a coach. She is a citizen of the Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara Nation. Kim, hello, and welcome to the show. It's great to have you.
Hello. Hi, everybody. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. Shannon, I want to begin with you. This is the 10th Annual Repatriation Conference. What important discussions are you looking forward to this year?
Well, I think first and foremost, I'm grateful for the 300 brave souls who are facing their fears with travel to join us here in Marksville with the Tunica-Biloxi Tribe. We're going to be doing intensive training on the new Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act regulations, which passed just a little bit more than a year ago, and institutions have been really doing well at producing notices, increasing the amount of consultation, and working towards repatriation. So we're spending a lot of time on those NAGPRA regulations. But Sean, we're also going to be talking about international repatriation. We'll be talking about the Safeguard Tribal Objects of Patrimony Act, whose regulations are hanging with the current administration, and some other really important issues that Native nations and institutions struggle with in their work to repatriate in a respectful way.
This all sounds really exciting, Shannon. Very relevant, of course, as well. Now, you've been on our show many, many times, and you've talked about progress in strengthening repatriation efforts. Can you tell us, let's start with some of the wins on the policy level and how they've been playing out?
Yeah, well, we had a set of regulations that for 30 years were completely ineffective. There were so many institutions that were causing harm and delay, wanting to create their own research projects out of the work that was supposed to be human rights work and just simple returns of our ancestors' bodies, sacred objects, burial belongings, cultural patrimony, these items that are really important for many of our nations and continuing our cultural practices and religious practices. So in January 24th, 2024, a brand new set of regulations were passed, and there were so many Native nations and advocates working to improve those regulations. And so those are out now. They've been out for a year. And some simple things in those regulations are really making all the difference. For example, consultation is really well defined by the new regulations, and it wasn't defined at all by the previous regulations. So now institutions understand what consultation means and how they're supposed to work with tribes to make those repatriation decisions. Another wonderful thing in these regulations that was a surprise from our advocacy, something that we had always advocated for, was the use of the term free, prior, and informed consent. When it comes to whether Native nations have given their permission to allow exhibitions of their cultural heritage or allow research to occur on their ancestors' remains, the new regulations implement the NAGPRA law fully by requiring institutions to get the free, prior, and informed consent of Native nations before they can do anything with the ancestors' bodies and cultural items in their collections. And the reason for that is because Congress declared that institutions may not have the right of possession unless they obtained that consent at the time of the taking. So it's a really powerful law. It always has been. It's been the regulations that have been a big, huge holdback. So I think we're on the mend, so to speak, now, except now we're waiting to see what this current administration is going to do to maybe mess things up again for us.
All right. All right. And for anybody new to Native America Calling, maybe you just have recently become a fan of the show, and we deal with these repatriation efforts quite a bit on their show. It's a very, very important issue and topic across Indian country. Anytime you might go to a museum or you see some sort of a collection that has Native American artifacts or anything related to Native American anthropology, as Native American people, we have a stake in those items and how they are presented and who has access to those items. So people like Shannon have been working diligently for many years to ensure that Native representation is displayed correctly and legally as well. And Shannon, let's talk about the federal layoffs and the spending cuts. Do you see any threats to repatriation work that you might be expecting this week to discuss?
Well, we're going to have a few folks from the federal government who may have some words to say about that, but we are very concerned. For one thing, over the last several years, the Department of Interior has provided $3 million each year to help institutions and tribes do this work. and return ancestors. And so we don't have any clue of what may be or may not be in the budget for the coming years. So we're concerned whether there's going to be funding to do this reparative work. Also, whether there'll be staff. I know that the staff that is in charge of overseeing the National NAGPRA program, just like everyone else in the federal government, gets their weekly email where they have to justify their existence. And on top of all of that, there was a stop of Federal Register notices. That might seem kind of a boring thing, but that's one of the steps with repatriation. Before repatriation can actually occur, the institution has to provide notice through the Federal Register that items or ancestors are affiliated with particular tribes, so that after 30 days after that notice is published, that repatriation can move forward. So those Federal Register notices have been stopped, supposedly temporarily. But the other work, the work between museums and tribes, will continue according to the law. And I guess the last thing to say on this point is one of the biggest entities that hasn't complied with NAGPRA are federal agencies. They are some of the worst in compliance with NAGPRA and hold thousands of ancestors' bodies and cultural items. And the BIA is one of the worst of those institutions. And so we're really concerned whether those agencies are going to be putting any effort into their compliance with NAGPRA.
Shannon O'Loughlin kicking off our discussion today here on Native America Calling. She is in Marksville, Louisiana. A big conference this week there with regard to repatriation efforts. So Shannon and many other repatriation advocates are en route right now to Marksville, Louisiana to participate in this conference. And we've got another guest on the show, actually two other guests on the show who are both going to be in attendance there in Marksville, Sam Cohn and Kim Mettler. So we're going to take a short break. We're going to come back. We're going to continue this conversation. And let's get some calls going here, folks, because I know this issue is important to you with regard to Native American graves protection and repatriation. Maybe you've got these issues in your community. Maybe you have artifacts. Maybe you have the remains of ancestors, and you'd like to talk about whether or not those people, those ancestors, are being taken care of. 1-800-996-2848.
The Donald Trump administration is continuing an aggressive and sometimes confusing program to cut federal employees, including hundreds of Indian education workers. We'll get a picture for how the job cuts affect tribes, schools, and Native American workers. That's all on the next Native America Calling.
Repatriation is the return of ancestors and stolen culture. The Association on American Indian Affairs and the Tunica-Biloxi Tribe will host the 10th Annual Repatriation Conference, February 25th, 26th, and 27th, 2025, in Marksville, Louisiana. The conference will provide expert hands-on training about domestic and international repatriation. Registration and more information available at Indian-Affairs.org. The Association on American Indian Affairs supports this show.
Taking away boys in our troubles.
Thank you for listening to Native America Calling. We're hearing about progress and possible setbacks impacting the work of repatriation. What repatriation stories do you have in your community? Have you seen the return of an ancestor or a cultural item that you're comfortable sharing? If so, you can join us with a comment or question by calling 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And a disclaimer about today's show again, the Association on Native American Indian Affairs is a financial sponsor for Native America Calling's parent company, Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation. Let's continue with Shannon O'Loughlin with the Association on American Indian Affairs. And Shannon, we've talked at length already about the Trump administration coming in now and a lot of the changes, a lot of the upheaval. What was repatriation and NAGPRA compliance like during Trump's last administration? And do you expect any type of similar behaviors or policies going forward?
Oh, that's a really good question. So the regulations for NAGPRA were still not out at that time. They had been even part of the Obama administration trying to revise those regulations. And so we didn't get the movement we wanted in the previous Trump administration to get those regulations passed. And so it was the Biden administration that ended up helping to support those revisions and getting that those regulations on the books. We didn't see a whole lot of interest from Trump's administration previously regarding NAGPRA specifically, but what we did see is that he made a point of taking a photo opportunity when there was a large international repatriation from Finland. It was either Finland or Sweden, I'm forgetting my Norwegian countries, with Mesa Verde items, really sensitive cultural items, back to about 22 different nations and pueblos in the Southwest. And so Trump did come out for that. He came out and did photo ops and an article and was pleased with the repatriation happen. Of course, from what I heard from many of the Native nations involved in that repatriation, they didn't want a spectacle. They didn't want the press. So it does show that there is an interest in repatriation and using it for diplomacy purposes by the Trump administration previously, but I can't say that I have any other evidence of that administration's support of repatriation otherwise.
All right. Now we're going to pivot to Sam Cohn here in a few minutes to talk about the STOP Act, but I want to ask you, how have laws and regulations around repatriation been bolstered in recent years? And Shannon, how do you see NAGPRA compliance evolve since the law was first put in the books all those years ago, 35 years plus, actually?
I'm sorry, were you asking me or Sam? You were asking
I'm
me?
I'm asking, yeah, before we bring Sam in, I wanted you to set the tone, I'm sorry.
And I apologize, we're live and I'm asking you to repeat that question.
How have the laws and regulations around repatriation been bolstered in recent years?
Yeah, there's been really great work over the last 4 years to strengthen repatriation law, like we said, with the NAGPRA regulations. But also there was a law that many of us were working to get passed since about 2016 called the Safeguard Tribal Objects of Patrimony Act. And that law prohibits the exportation of our cultural heritage to other countries. That's how we lose a lot of our items, because they have wound up in private collections. And so the most sensitive of those items often end up And we see the dealers from the U.S. doing this all the time, shipping them overseas because they can sell them without so much blowback from native country if it was from a domestic auction. So we have less going for us at an international auction. And so what the STOP Act can do is help prevent those items from going overseas. So that law was passed by Biden, I think, in the end of 2023, if I remember that right, but I'm sure Sam can correct me. What we are waiting for now are the regulations, which many Native nations commented on. There was a proposed rulemaking. That's when the federal government provides a draft set of regulations for the law, and many of us provided our feedback and comments, and that was in December of 2024, and of course we haven't heard anything since. So a lot of the work that we've done to get the law to look like we need it to look so that this work can occur, for example, the STOP Act is just on hold, and we don't know where it's going to go now.
All right. Sam Cohn, please, like to have you join the conversation now with the Denver-based law firm Kaplan Kirsch, LLP. Sam, you were one of the main people that worked on writing the STOP Act. Give us some history here with regard to the origin and really the needs that it fills for tribes.
Sure. Thanks, Sean. Nice to be here with you this morning. And I think Shannon sets a fantastic foundation there, that the STOP Act serves to add a element for NAGPRA and the Archaeological Resources Protection Act focused on international export of objects of cultural patrimony, our cultural history, as Shannon calls it. The way that works is by creating an obligation under federal law in the United States Code to have the Department of Homeland Security take a look at the list of items being exported and compare that to a list which tribes provide to the Department of the Interior. And if any object on that list is being exported, then the object would be subject to a NAGPRA-like repatriation process. It's a byproduct of, as Shannon suggested, and has been a strong proponent of, a lengthy process from a number of tribes, Pueblos, Alaska Native groups, entities across Indian country who for too long have seen their objects appear at auction internationally and in international museums with no clear way to request those objects come home under United States law. Of course, there are some related provisions of international law, but the STOP Act would be the first step toward fulfilling the United States' obligations to allow Indian tribes to take advantage of those provisions under international law. So, a critical missing puzzle piece for stopping the export of objects of cultural heritage from the United States into the international collections landscape.
Sam, any estimate as to the percentage of artifacts or objects of cultural heritage that are currently situated overseas as opposed to here in the U.S.?
Boy, Sean, that's a great question, but I went to law school, so I did not have to take mathematical guesses. So I would just say the answer is more than Indian tribes want. You know, you pop over to the any of the national museums in Europe or in Japan or anywhere across the world, and in their North American collections, you're likely to see objects from Indian country. And of course, what's on exhibit is a small fraction of what is in the museum's collection at any given time. So rather than giving you a percentage, I'll just say much, much more than Indian country wants.
All right. Now, as Shannon mentioned earlier, the STOP Act is currently on hold. What do you see for the future here, Sam?
Yeah, I think Shannon, again, hit the nail on the head there. Let me add a little bit of color to her statement. So the STOP Act passed Congress, and by passing Congress and being signed into law by President Biden in 2022, that means that the provisions within the STOP Act are now parts of the United States Code. So if somebody is to export an object of cultural patrimony, they have that would be subject to the STOP Act, they have violated federal law. They would be punished. Their action could be punished under federal law, right? So there's some broad structural pieces to which bad actors would be punished and would be required to follow under a United States Code right now. As Shannon referenced, those broad pieces of how the law works would be explained more and expanded upon with the passage of regulations implementing the STOP Act. So the text of the bill of United States Code of the law as it stands right now directs that within a year after December of 2022, the Department of the Interior was supposed to issue regulations causing the STOP Act to go into effect. Having just worked at DOI, I can tell you 1 year is a very optimistic timeline for any sort of rulemaking. I was part of the team that worked really hard to make that happen. We did a very robust consultation across Indian country and with the Native Hawaiian community in the spring and summer of 2023. And as Shannon mentioned, there was a draft rule put out and a lot of progress made towards a final rule. However, with the recent regulatory freeze from President Trump, the final rule is not yet been published. And I think the prospects of that, from where I sit today, are nerve-wracking at best. I would say the likelihood is tough to parse, only because the Trump administration has issued a executive order which says that if any agency wants to create a new regulation, take any steps in the regulatory process, that will require the identification of 10 other regulations that will be taken off the books. And Indian law is this sort of highly complicated regulatory process across the board, and taking 10 of those pieces away, I think would be a tall order for anybody who's worked in the field to select 10 of them that should be taken down. So short answer to your question, Sean, where do things stand? From where I sit now, it looks like it's a tough ask unless there's some litigation asking the Trump administration to get moving on the STOP Act regulations.
All right, Sam. Thank you so much. Kim Mettler is also on the show today. She's already in Marksville, Louisiana. And Kim, you're one of the opening speakers at the conference this week. Tell us more about the message that you're going to make to other repatriation advocates.
Hi. Yeah. Well, I think my message, and I'm just listening to Shannon and Sam, is really reiterating for me, the message is, please, relatives doing this work, take care of yourself. Be intentional, no matter how difficult it may feel. Be intentional about the ways you care for yourself, the way you source yourself for the fight and for the struggle in the moment and that lies ahead. I think of it as I'm asking all of my repatriation warrior relatives, it's like you can't feed someone when your kitchen is empty. When you don't have anything in your cupboards or in your fridge, you can't feed anybody. And so how you take care of yourself, how you take care of each other in community is filling your kitchen and your fridge up so you have something to offer. And so that's the takeaway that I hope people will receive.
All right. And I'm really glad you're on the show today, Kim, because it's easy sometimes with these types of conversations to really focus a lot on the policies and the laws, and we have to remember the enormous emotional impact as well for people like yourselves who do this kind of work. And I find it interesting because you're also a lawyer. When did you first realize the importance of the self-care and mindful practices that you're talking about now?
Well, gosh, it was a while ago. I think Creator was trying to teach me while I was a lawyer, because that's hard. I was in-house counsel for a Native nation, and it was actually after I left and I started working in child welfare that it became, you know, the toxicity of ongoing constant stress of doing those kinds of jobs, but also being a Native Jewish woman doing those kinds of jobs, and always being, you know, facing colonial worldview, and it takes a toll on your health. And I've struggled. I've been working on mental health, being healthy mentally for many years. And as a result of stress and not particularly taking care of myself, I also now get to manage chronic illness. And so, you know, about 15 years ago, I started doing acupuncture. I started a yoga practice. I started an on-again, off-again meditation practice. But I'd say over about the last 5 years, I've gotten really serious about this as a coach. I know in my work as a coach and being with people and supporting others, it's become clear that I need to be sourced to help other people. And I can't, as a coach, really tell clients and tell others and support others to say, hey, you have to go take care of yourself if I'm also not doing that. And I just know that, I'm not perfect. I'm not going to say that, you know, my practices are perfect, because they're certainly not. But I do notice there's a huge difference when I am taking time daily, even if it's just a few minutes, to do something that is intentionally self-care.
Thank you, Kim, so much. We're going to take another short break. We're going to continue the conversation on the other side. And we still got the phone lines open, and we would very much like for some listeners to join our conversation today. If you are in any way involved with repatriation efforts, or you just have a thought or a question to share with regard to these issues, give us a call, 1-800-996-2848. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Support for law and justice related programming provided by Hobbs Strauss Dean and Walker LLP, a national law firm dedicated to promoting and defending tribal rights for over 40 years. More information available at HobbsStrauss.com.
See Renewal's expertise in energy, housing, land use, fire protection, and more in multi-jurisdictional environments helps tribes leverage existing assets, grow capacity, and gain competitive advantage. See Renewal supports this show. SEERenewal.com.
When you file online for your Permanent Fund Dividend, every Alaskan can support great causes, including Native America Calling. Just use Pick, Click, Give, and select KNBA-FM, Kwanic Broadcast Corporation. Through your support, you can help us make a difference in our community when you pick, click, give for causes you care about. With one donation at a time, good things will happen all over Alaska.
This program is supported by AmeriCorps Vista. Through service with AmeriCorps Vista, you gain valuable professional experience and leadership skills while helping organizations in your community alleviate poverty. Find a service opportunity at AmeriCorps.gov/Vista today. That's AmeriCorps.gov/Vista.
DT Track, your healthcare partner, provides access to a nationwide network of qualified healthcare temporary staff, including medical billing professionals that optimize your revenue cycles. More at dt-track.com who support this show. Support by AARP. AARP creates and connects people to unique tools and programs, helps conserve personal resources, and tackles issues that matter most to individuals, families, and communities. More at aarp.org.
You're listening to Native America Calling. We're talking about repatriation today, and there is still time for you to join. Just pick up that phone you've got nearby and tap 1-800-996-2848 on your touchscreen keypad. Or leave a comment on our social media pages and website. Earlier, we mentioned that we will talk about artifacts and other items that have been accumulated by a Florida real estate company that is sidestepping tribal consultation. Let's do that now. And to have that conversation, we have Betty Osceola on the line in Florida. She is a Miccosukee environmental educator. Betty, hello, and welcome back to Native America Calling.
Oh, thank you for having me.
It's great to have you back on the show, Betty. And please give us some background on this real estate company, the Related Group, and the issues you've been raising about the disruption of Native objects and remains.
Well, the company Related Group acquired a property in downtown Miami that is across from the Miami Circle that happens to be protected. And it's actually before US 1 divided that piece of property, it was all connected together as one large encampment of Tequesta people. And Related Group purchased the property to build some condos and shops on that property. And it wasn't until after they had already gotten their permits and started excavations did we find out what was going on and the amount of artifacts that were being removed off that property. But from the get-go, Related Group had been very reluctant to speak to tribal people because it's private property. And unfortunately, in Florida, when artifacts are found on private owned property, the state of Florida doesn't really get involved. So that's where they say NAGPRA doesn't apply because it's considered, I guess whoever the property owner is, Florida considers anything that's found on that property belonging to the property owner. So that's been the biggest hurdle to try to overcome. But the amount of items found is enormous. And it's outside of human remains, there's a lot of other pottery and other things that have been found. And I do understand that they have spoken to the Seminole tribe, but I don't know what those conversations are. But we do understand that the group that it's Jorge Perez does not want any of the items reburied back on the property as we have been requesting.
Betty, can you tell us what are they doing with these objects and these remains right now? Where are they housing or storing them?
Well, there's a parking garage. There's two pieces of property and with two different addresses, but we call it 44 Brickell. I consider it the same property. And there's a remaining building that has a parking garage, and they're storing those items in that parking garage. To me, it's very disrespectful. The archaeologist on the project of record is Robert Carr, who was actually involved when the initial Miami Circle was found and excavated, and he was instrumental in helping protect that site, and he's the archaeologist there. But what we found out that was very alarming is that Related Group had sent out mass inquiries to different organizations and universities trying to see if they would accept all these artifacts. And we weren't even aware that they had done that. It wasn't until a professor at University of Miami received an email from Berkeley alerting them to the email that went out, and Berkeley's response to that inquiry that they were even appalled by the suggestion that was put out by Related.
Mm-hmm. Betty, what are some possible solutions that you and others that are involved in this fight have thoughts about? I know the Florida AIM chapter is involved as well.
Yes. Yes, they are. They've been, Robert Rosa with AIM has been very supportive and travels down. But what we have been asking from the get-go is that they rebury everything, reinter everything that they found back into the property. And that we were even open to, if they want to build, instead of excavating, just leave everything in place and build near it. Because some of it's going to be a promenade area and like a park and walkway. You know, Related did say that they want to honor the sequesta, but they want to build some kind of walking path and a museum and put some of the artifacts into the museum. And we're saying we don't want any artifacts to go into the museum. They can always have a replica or do some type of imaging that over the site and interpretive area to educate. But we've always asked that everything not to go into museums to be studied, because that's one of the things that they're offering to these universities is to take, to accept them and do studies on them, and we don't want any type of DNA sampling to occur. But so there's that resistance where Related does not want to put anything back into the ground. And they were supposed to give an updated inventory to the Seminole tribe, and Miccosukee has requested it of everything that they have found on the property, and they have yet to do that. They to have a complete inventory. They gave a partial inventory, but they said it'll still be another 2 years. But in the meantime, Miami is just letting them continue to do what they're doing. We want everything back in the ground.
Mm-hmm. Betty, have you had a chance to speak personally with anyone at the Related group? And if so, what's their tone overall?
They're very disrespectful. They don't want to hear what the indigenous people have to say. And we've been in multiple meetings, public meetings, to express our concerns. And they just don't want to hear what the indigenous people have to say. In their minds, they own the objects, and they have the right to decide where they go and who gets them. They don't want to listen to any of the ancestors, to the descendants of the people who are there. In their mind, they own everything and can do whatever they want with it.
What about the public there in that part of Florida? Are they speaking out at all? Non-natives, I'm thinking about,
well,
just people living in the area.
Well, some of the public are saying to respect what the indigenous people want, but some members of the public feel that they have the right to see all these items, and they want to those items to go into a museum, because in their minds, the public should be able to see these artifacts in a museum setting. And so I don't, you know, and my thing as well, then go dig up your own relatives and put them in a museum and see how you feel about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they don't understand the indigenous perspective and what they're doing and desecrating our ancestors. It's very hard to get that point across to non-indigenous people.
All right, Betty. Really appreciate you taking the time. I know you're really busy and you're really involved in this fight there in Florida. So thank you again for just joining the show and educating our listeners today. We've got a couple of callers lined up, but before we do that, I want to pivot quickly back to Shannon O'Loughlin. And Shannon, Betty mentioned that NAGPRA does not apply in this case because these items are held by a private company. It begs the question, how much leverage do repatriation advocates have in this situation in Florida?
Yeah, it's really difficult. Every state, if the land is not federal land or tribal land or potentially part of a federally funded project, there is very little that can be done often, and we're just reliant on the state law. One way that NAGPRA could potentially be used
by this, which goes against really what I'm hearing Betty saying, that the tribal advocates there want. But if an institution curated and accepted those items into their collection, then they would be obligated to repatriate them under NAGPRA. So, you know, there could be other types of workarounds, but likely with the current status of Florida law, it's not going to be what the advocates there would really like to see happen, which is returning to the soil where they came mm-hmm. from.
All right. Thanks, Shannon. We've got a couple of callers. First up is Zach, who's listening on KUNM in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hello, Zach. What is your comment?
Hi. I just wanted to express a kind of concern. I have some friends that, you know, have been laid off from their work with the Forest Service. I have a lot of friends that are involved in archaeology and have those same kind of concerns. And the kind of tangent that I have that relates to the repatriation kind of conversation is that I used to be a state employee, and I was kind of in the maintenance world in between, you know, historians and park rangers kind of deal, but I just dealt more with the grounds themselves. And I worked on indigenous lands all over New Mexico. And one of the things that I had to, like, took very seriously as a part of my job was, you know, I can remember specifically in Jemez, we were digging in a new water line, like replacing a leaded line. It's a normal, good project, but we discovered a bone at one point we were digging the line. And mm-hmm. you wouldn't believe the argument that I had to have with the contractors just to stop the work that day. And so when I think about the political kind of turmoil that it feels like we're in right now, I really do worry about stuff like this, you know, tiny stories like mine that are just going to be happening
okay.
without oversight, you know, all over the country now.
Zach, let me ask you.
Protections. Yes,
let me ask you a quick question before we take the next call. In a situation like that you describe, where you're on a dig, or not even a dig, an excavation, some kind of construction project, and you've got a contractor and a bone is discovered, in this situation, you're there, you're going to advocate, but if nobody is there to advocate, how easy is it for them just to disregard that bone or whatever artifact it is and just continue with the job?
I would say that's almost, you know, it gives me, like, nightmares to think about that kind of deal, but it's easier than saying anything at all. We're in these pretty remote areas, and it's usually just the crew that's, you know, doing the work themselves, so it's really just up to them. If they decide they don't want to deal with the paperwork, the headache, the loss of a few hours, you know, to all contact right. The tribe nearby. But, yeah, it's a bummer.
Zach, really appreciate you calling in. Wonderful, wonderful call from Albuquerque, New Mexico. Zach, who listens on KUNM. Let's go now to Daniel, who's listening on KNNB in Arizona. Hello, Daniel. You're on the air.
Hello, good morning. I just wanted to say this is such an interesting topic. I just got into grad school at Arizona State University for this new class, and I'm really looking forward to going into learning about anthropology, archaeology, and learning more about the indigenous views and going more into NAGPRA studies. So I just wanted to say it was a great topic today. I learned so much. I got to reflect on a lot of things.
Well, Daniel, thank you for calling in. I'm glad that this show is resonating with you, and I hope you'll continue listening to Native America Calling in the future, very much so. And I want to pivot back to Kim Mettler because, Kim, hearing these personal stories, hearing Betty Osceola describe what it's like dealing with this realty company and the attitude they have, and then the caller Zach who knows what it's like to be on a construction site and have a contractor push back, this really underscores what you're talking to us about today with regard to our mental health. So how do you begin that conversation with folks who are working in this field and encourage them to get their mental health taken care of and address that in addition to all the other responsibilities that they have doing this kind of work?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. And as I was listening to both of them, I have to tell you, my heart started really pounding because I was really angry. It's just like, I was mm-hmm. just thinking about how many folks are out there that stand in the face of this colonial and institutional entitlement. right? That's what this is. And what I would say to them is, it's actually taking care of yourself, not just mental health, but physical and spiritual health. You have what you need to do inside of you right at this moment. It is as simple as taking a deep breath. When faced with that moment where you know there's a bone in the ground and nobody's going to stop their construction project, that, you know, dysregulates, you get upset in all of the ways. And what you can do to help yourself in that moment is take a deep breath. It can literally be that simple. But there are all kinds of other simple practices that you can use to help get your body regulated again and help bring things in balance. And I just want to say, I feel really strongly, especially for Native folks who are listening, so many of the expressions of our culture, so many of our cultural practices are the medicines that help us in that way. I was thinking about somebody I know who does beadwork. And when she gets stressed out and when she gets upset and she's had a hard day, the first thing she does is come home and she sits down with her beads. And I think about things like our ceremony and prayer. What you do in ceremony and prayer requires a type of present moment awareness that helps regulate your mind, your body, and spirit. And sometimes you can't do those things, you know, in the moment, like what Miss Betty was talking about when she's arguing with that contractor. She can't stop and do beadwork or basketry or whatever mm-hmm. helps her. But when you find the time on a regular basis to develop these practices, they will help strengthen you. They help shore up your resolve and your resilience so that you can face those things in the best possible way, so that you can channel your anger in a good way and use it as it's intended as a weapon, right?
All right. Kim, thank you so much. I'm sorry we're out of time. We're going to have to wrap up the conversation. But thank you to all of our guests who joined the show today, Shannon O'Loughlin, Sam Cohn, Kim Mettler, Betty Osceola, and also the callers who contributed as well. Appreciate all of you. And join us again tomorrow. We'll look at the effect the current federal layoffs are having across education, tribal programs, and other work in Indian Country. Hope you'll tune in. I'm Sean Spruce.
Skugtash. For more than 40 years, Ramona Farms has revived ancient traditional foods, tepary beans, pinoli, polentas, and more, all from store.ramonafarms.com. Ramona Farms supports this show. Omye.
Fry bread. That's the message. Support by Val's Fry Bread, providing her famous fry bread mixes and other products in wholesale and retail quantities at valsfrybread.com. Fry bread that will take you home, available wherever you live.
Program support by AmeriCorps Vista, where you can kickstart your career and help others in your community. With AmeriCorps Vista, you can serve in an office setting and address issues of poverty while gaining career experience and building your leadership skills. Learn more by visiting AmeriCorps.gov/Vista today. That's AmeriCorps.gov/Vista.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.